when you guys see me walk in a suit, one of two things is going to happen. Either I'm going to a funeral or I'm getting the opportunity to preach a message. I realized that this morning, this must be my funeral suit because I reached in my pocket and I got a whole collection of cards from funeral homes in here. And Brother Roy has the suit that I really want. I keep telling him, I wish you'd hurry up and die because he told me I could have it when he dies. But he's hanging on like a hair in a biscuit right now, I'm telling you. Tomorrow commemorates the 55th anniversary of something that we call Memorial Day. It was previously known as Decoration Day, and it was actually soon after the Civil War was over, and it was meant to honor veterans who had died in combat. Now, a lot of people get Memorial Day and Veterans Day confused. Memorial Day commemorates veterans who died in action in combat, and Veterans Day commemorates veterans in general, whether they died in combat or they just served. So today, and tomorrow, we'll be observing the day that's set aside for the 1.3 million Americans who died in service for our country. Which is a very interesting point because Brother Dillard and I were out in the front porch while ago talking, and some guy walked up that neither one of us recognized before, and he looked at Dillard and he said, "Hey, Pastor," he said, "why do you have your flag flying at half staff?" And Brother Dillard thought for a second and correctly said, "Well, brother, that's for all the people that died in the service." And the guy kind of scratched his head and he looked at Brother Dillard and he said, "Would that have been the 11 o'clock service or the 6 o'clock service?" Dilbert's relieved because he couldn't remember that conversation we had on the porch while ago. One of the jobs I inherited when I, quote, retired was we have a family cemetery on my property. It's got 44 tombstones on it, and I get to mow it. And it's only about an acre, but when you mow around tombstones, you can multiply that times 10. Don't worry about that. But as I mow that cemetery, I look at those graves, and there's people in that cemetery who are 100 years old when they died, and there's people in that cemetery who was only 1 or 2 or 3 years old when they died. And in both situations, I don't even honestly think about the remains of the bodies that were in that grave. I'm usually drawn to the people who are left behind, and especially the young children that are in those graves, those parents, and what they had to endure to go through that event. And it's a sad thing. And I remember when I taught at Scott High, I taught anthropology, and I taught a unit called Death and Dying. And we would study the rituals associated with death across all the cultures of the world, including our own. And one of the things I would do is I'd take them to a funeral home. And we would go on a field trip to a funeral home, and we would get the particulars of the embalming process. They would take us in the embalming room. Something I didn't know is that when they embalm you, they had a toilet sitting there, and the embalming hose went right into the regular toilet that goes right into the regular system, and that's where all that material goes, right in the Huntsville River when it comes to here locally. And then we'd also go into where the coffins and caskets were, and we would talk about those, and I've always said that, you know, dying is a multi-billion dollar industry, and the cost of a coffin is astronomical in regards to what it costs to make a coffin, is all I'll say. I'll put it that way. And they've got you at a vulnerable point where you're sad and you're disheartened, and they're trying to make you feel really good about the situation and that person's body, and they're going to try to sell you a coffin, and they're going to try to sell you a sealed casket, and they're going to try to sell you a vault. They're going to sell you all kinds of things that really just don't matter in the afterlife whatsoever. But a lot of times we do it. But I would want my kids to see that, and I want them to see it up close and personal. And then I would take them down to Brother Howard's property down there, River Road Cemetery, and I would show them some amazing graves down there. When we first started going down there, it looked like a scary movie. English Ivy had taken the whole cemetery over. And if I was ever going to film a scary movie, I would have went down there, because there are graves down there that have something called crypts on them. And what a crypt is over the grave is a stone building, stone structure. And it's made out of cut stone. They're finely cut. They're really amazing. And those down there at River Road, some of them are pushing 200 years old. And there's several like that. And there's one other cemetery in Scott County that I think somewhere around Winona, there's one crypt. But this particular cemetery has all kinds of crypts in it. And I wanted them to see that. And then we would talk about, like I said, the cultures of other countries. And it was a good segue for me to talk about the afterlife, which I took every opportunity I could with them. And I would tell them this. I said, you know, there's two things that separate humans from the rest of the animal world. Number one, we have ritual when we die. Animals do not. We associate death with some type of ritual. No matter what culture it is, there is a ritual. And the second thing is, we actually know we're going to die. My dog Molly, she's getting pretty old. She's a golden retriever. Her face is bleached white, and she likes to lay on the porch a whole lot lately, where she's always out running around. And her day is coming. She don't realize it. But when we get to that point in our lives, we realize it, you know. So, and then the final thing I would do is we would actually go on digs, archaeological digs. And we would uncover artifacts that were a lot of times associated with death. And probably the most famous, Senator Baker, I'm not a name dropper. Senator Baker could run me in public and he wouldn't know who I was. Especially now, because he's one of the ones we're talking about and planted in a grave. But he called one day and said that he had some property he wanted my anthropology class to excavate. So we go down there, and the way it worked, I had that the last period of the day, and we would go and we would stay until they had to leave. And a lot of times some of them have to leave right at the end of the day at 3 o'clock. We would drive down there in carpools, park on the property, and a lot of kids would leave as soon as the school day was over. And some would stay till we literally had headlights on excavating at night. That continuous. That's how much they were into it. And I had kids spread out all over that bluff that overlooked Huntsville River. And it was kind of a nervous situation. I'm by myself, and I've got 30 kids, and I got them in groups of four. And we're excavating rock shelters, cliffs underneath. And they were probably spread out, those rock shelters, for 300 or 400 yards. So I may have somebody at 400 yards away and somebody on the other end of the spectrum. And I can remember one evening in September, kids getting very animated and yelling and screaming. And the first thing I thought, somebody got bit by a copperhead, honestly, because it was that time of year where snakes were heading to those areas. And I take off running like last Mohicans through the side of that cliff. And I get down there to them. And they had uncovered a partial skull. We would dig an area about the size of this pulpit as a test unit, we called it. Then right over here would be the skull that was just barely sticking through their test unit. So we moved over and roped it off or marked it off, and we went down further to see what all was there. And University of Tennessee ended up carbon dating this. That grave ended up being about 3,000 years old. And it had rituals associated with it. There were artifacts that were buried with it, cut stone that were perfectly squared, that were on top of the body. And it was interesting because it was a female. The University of Tennessee did something called osteology on it. And with the female right next to it was an infant child. And if back in those days, if mom died, baby's going to die too. There's nothing to do about it. She probably died from an abscess tooth is what they determined. Because back in those days, if you had an abscess tooth, and you would get this because they ate a lot of corn. They would grind corn, and that corn would be ground with sandstone. When the sandstone would mix with the ground corn, you would eat it. It would wear the enamel off your teeth, and then the corn having a lot of sugar content would cause tooth decay. So you know, they didn't have anything on us back then as far as tooth decay goes. They had it. But the only difference was when you had an abscess, there was no curing it. And today, if you get an abscess tooth, the dentist is not going to pull that tooth until he gives you antibodies to take care of that abscess, because if he pulls the tooth, that abscess will find its way to the brain. There's a good chance you'll die. So it was interesting. All this death surrounds us, you know. I tried to get them to understand that different cultures treat death in different ways. But the bottom line is that when it's all over, no matter what culture it is, they're all dead. And literally, from the time I'm preaching this message today, there will be about 8,000 people worldwide die today, in this hour. You're looking at that times 24, times 365. You're looking at millions and millions of deaths a year. And tomorrow, we're going to observe Memorial Day, previously referred to, like I said, as Decoration Day. And there's 144,000 cemeteries in the United States. And there's going to be millions of people tomorrow walking over those cemeteries, honoring deceased loved ones. And each individual grave will have a granite slab of stone that marks the location of that person's final interment. And in most cases, that's going to be the only monument that will last for any amount of time, depicting who that person was. Because everything else will be gone, even their houses usually, whatever they leave behind, just memories. But as far as a monument goes, that is it. That's the monument that is the lasting monument to their existence. And each stone will have the person's name on it. It'll have their birthday, and it'll have their death day on it. And each stone will have something on it called an epitaph. Now that epitaph is kind of a one sentence or a one phrase summation of that person's life. Now, you imagine living 100 years and you've got this much space on a tombstone to tell you who that person was and what they were like. And each stone, and I've never seen one contrary to this, it's always good. Everything on that stone's good. You'll never see Joe Smith, he was a sorry drunk. You'll never see that on tombstone. It's always going to be something wonderful. And it's most times it is something spiritual. I mean, you'll see things like safe in the arms of Jesus, or forever with the Lord. Jesus called and Joe answered. And there's often going to be some type of a scripture accompanied with that epitaph, like the Lord is my shepherd, or well done, thou good and faithful servant. But what I wonder, in all my time dealing with cemeteries, mowing cemeteries, and going to other, that anthropology class, we went to cemeteries all over the county, looking at very interesting things. There's cemeteries in Scott County that only black people are buried in. At one time in Scott County, over 10% of our population was black. And those people have their own cemetery because they weren't allowed to be buried in white cemeteries. And they're all throughout the county. But I wonder of all those cemeteries and all those tombstones, when I walk around and I look at them, I wonder how much of them are falsely portraying the testimony of its inhabitants. You know. The title of this morning's message is called Christless Graves. What does the inside of a Christless grave look like? Well, the inside of a Christless grave will look exactly like the inside of a Christian grave. There'll be no difference in them whatsoever. In 15 years, the only thing that will be remaining in a good old-fashioned wooden casket in 15 years will be your bones. That's it. Your skin's gone. Now, if you fall for it and you go ahead and get a metal sealed casket and a very expensive vault to put that casket in, you'll have 75 years left with your skin and your bones while you're laying there thinking about, well, I'm glad they got me a vault and a sealed casket. My skin's still with me. And I think something that's even more interesting is the fact that the average American will spend in their lifetime $151,000 on their physical appearance in your lifetime. That sounds astronomical. But that includes your clothes, your hygiene, your makeup, your haircuts, all the things in between if you decide to have plastic surgery because maybe some unfortunate accident, or maybe you just didn't like the way God made you. Whatever it is, there's going to be a whole lot of money spent in your lifetime on your actual physical appearance. And not only is there going to be a lot of, you know, when I think about that, I want a refund, by the way, when it comes time for me to die. I mean, money not well spent. And when I think about that, you will also spend 14,500 hours in your lifetime on your physical appearance. That's grooming and shaving and makeuping and bathing and all the things we do, hygiene, to make ourselves look better than we really look. And I really got feeling guilty about the amount of time that we spend on our physical appearance. And a lot of people think I'm just bald-headed, but I'm not. I decided to be bald-headed because I couldn't justify the fact I was spending so much time washing my hair, blow-drying my hair, grooming my hair. I felt guilty about that, so I decided to shave all my hair off. And that doesn't even count the amount of time I used to stand in front of a mirror admiring my hair. So I just came to terms with God. God, I don't think you want me to have hair. So I just started shaving it all. But how much time do we spend improving who we really are and what we look like to others as opposed to what we really are, which is not what you're seeing right now? Not at all. All that time and money is being spent on something we're not. It may be something we're pretending to be, but it's something that we're really not. Our spirit is who we really are. And this body just houses that spirit. There will be a time in our lives where the physical appearance will not matter at all. And sometimes that'll be later in life when we're elderly. And sometimes it's going to be younger in life. I just recently buried a brother-in-law who's in his 40s, and the last weeks of his life, his appearance was just staggering. I mean, you wouldn't even have known it was him. I mean, he played football for University of Nebraska, and good-looking guy. And when I went there and looked at him laying in that bed those last few days, I wouldn't even known his. I wouldn't even know who it was. That appearance does not matter anymore. So the point of my message about Christless Grace is, how do we avoid Christless grace for the people we encounter in our lives? And there's really only two things that we can do to avoid a Christless grave for someone that we care about, someone that we encounter, friends, family, or someone that we just don't even know, but we witness to. How can we make sure that that grave will not be a Christless grave? And in all honesty, the most important thing you can do to avoid a Christless grave for somebody else is to avoid a Christless grave for yourself. That's first and foremost. It's the airplane theory. When you're getting ready to take off and that stewardess is giving you flight instructions about what's going to happen when the plane takes off, and they tell you if they have a problem, the first thing you better do when that oxygen mask drops is you put it on your face, not anybody else's around you. And then once you get it taken care of, you may be able to help the people around you. So what we need to do when we're trying to look at a Christless grave and how to avoid those, we need to make sure that our own isn't a Christless grave, first and foremost. Abraham Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all the time, and you can fool all the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time. Well, that may be true, but I'm going to tell you something, something else you can't do. You will never be able to fool God any of the time, any of the time. Turn to Hebrews, if you don't care. In your Bible, turn to Hebrews 4:14. Hebrews 4:14. None of us have to endure a Christless grave. And Hebrews 4:14 is a verse that I've heard from a pulpit most of my life. 4:14 says, seeing then that we have a great high priest that has passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. For we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, but yet without sin. Now, I think that's a pretty telling verse, and it's a verse we hear a lot. But I think there's a very interesting verse that goes along with that really provides the context for those two verses. Look right above there in verse 13, Hebrews 4:13. The context of what I just said in 4:14 comes from verse 13. And this is where we need to take note. And you don't hear this very often. And what it says is, neither is there any creature that is not manifest in his sight. In his sight. But all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him with whom we have to do. Now that puts 14 and 15 in context, and that person is Christ. And all things, it says, not some of the things, not just the good things, all things are naked and open unto the eyes of him. And who do we have to do? In our case, it's going to be Jesus, if we have a profession of faith. Hebrews 9:27 says, and it is appointed unto men once to die, but after this, the judgment. There's going to be some form of judgment coming, guys, regardless. Whether it's the great white throne judgment or judgment seat of Christ, there's going to be a judgment on us. 2 Corinthians 5:10 says, for we must all appear. And you know, these are just so simple, these verses. You don't have to have a PhD in theology to understand anything I'm saying right here. A child can understand this. But sometimes we make it such much more complicated than it really is. I think because we're trying to figure out a way to wiggle out of some of the accountability we have in our own lives. And that's not going to happen. And if you're hoping it will, you have some false pretense there, because it's not. But it says, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone, may receive the things done in his body according to that which he hath done, whether it be good. It's easy to understand what that means. You don't need a PhD in Latin or Greek to understand that. Or whether it be bad, same thing. But here's the verse that I think is really telling about what Paul just said in verse 10. He said, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord. Okay, he doesn't say the long-suffering, the mercy, although that's true. Well, that's true. But he says, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord. What are we supposed to do? We persuade men, and it even gets better. But we, us persuaders, are made manifest unto God. And I trust also are made manifest in your or our consciences. We know. He's telling us that. God knows. We know. I don't care what kind of act we're putting on or what dog we're putting on. Our conscience knows. You know, I would not trade my spirit for Delbert Terry's. I know some of you think, boy, you lost your mind. We've got the greatest pastor I've ever been under in my entire life. I believe 100% that we're going to be in heaven together. Would I be willing to trade my spirit for his? No, I wouldn't. And you shouldn't either. Because I know, my conscience knows what I did. I know what he's told me he did. And based on his testimony and what he does, his life, I believe him. But I know my own experience. And it's just like the flight instruction. Take care of yourself before you take off trying to take care of somebody else. The second thing you can do is take. Once you've settled that, by the way, and guys, don't go through life thinking, well, I prayed this prayer when I was a little boy, and it was something like, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, God bless me as I go. That prayer has sent a lot of people to hell, and I'm not trying to talk to anybody out of salvation. Absolutely not. I just want to make sure you understand that just because you said a prayer and did not understand fully what you were praying does not mean you're necessarily want to avoid a Christless grave someday. You've got to settle that thing. It's kind of like this, guys. If a house is burning down and there is somebody on the third floor of that house and there is no way they can go back into the house to escape, their only option is jump and die. Or the fire truck arrives and it raises a ladder up to the third floor. That person's salvation at that time is what? What is it? I'll help you. It's the ladder, okay? There's nothing deep about that. It's that ladder. Will that ladder save that person, though? Will it? No, it won't save that person. It could sit there until it gets so hot you can't put your hands on it. But until that person decides to get on that ladder, it's not going to save their life. And guys, that's how salvation works, guys. It's free. It's not accomplished by works. But you got to get on the ladder. And if you've never done that, then you need to come to terms with yourself, as Paul said, in your own conscience. And realize that and forget your pride. Forget what you've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years. And come to terms with the fact, this is bigger than just me pretending to be something that I'm not. And fix that right there. And once that happens, then you have the opportunity to start telling others about Christ. So number two, the second, there's only two things. Fix yourself and help fix others. Remember those. Simple. Not a list of 10 or 5 things, remember. Take care of yourself. Make sure you're not going to occupy a Christless grave yourself. And the second thing is take every ripe opportunity to preach Christ. And I put that word ripe in there. And some of you may not like this, but if I said to you, take every opportunity you have to preach Christ, none of us do that. We really don't. I mean, it'd almost be impossible. But if you took every ripe opportunity to preach Christ, it would not be impossible. What do I mean by a ripe opportunity? A ripe opportunity to me is when the Holy Spirit is leading me to witness to someone. And it might be because the Holy Spirit is convicting the person I'm being led to witness to about something. Just a few weeks ago, I had a player I was taking home from practice. And the reason I was taking him home was because one of our members that worked at the physical therapy place was talking to him about his own salvation, bless her heart. I'd coached him for 7 months and never had a conversation with him about it. But she's there doing therapy with him, and she asked him about his eternal state and his salvation, if he'd ever been saved. And he just blatantly looked at her and said, no, I've not been. And here's what I mean. Well, you know what she should have done? She should have stopped work right there and said, hey, I'm going to go witness to this guy. Life doesn't work that way, guys. You know what she did? She said, I'm going to call Coach Sexton when I get a chance, and I'm going to tell him what you just told me. And then she called Coach Sexton. Well, Coach Sexton said, hey, Jace, I need to take you home from practice, if you don't mind. He said, yeah, let's do it tomorrow. Well, he gets in the car, and his best friend gets in the back seat. And already I'm thinking, okay. And the first thing I said, hey, Jonah, you ever been saved? He said, yeah. I said, okay, good. And from Sky High all the way to Winfield, I was talking to Jace about salvation. He was right. I mean, he was hanging on every word I said. And there was no pretense, nothing fake about it. Nothing that he was just trying to please me because I was his coach. He had already told her that I'm not saved. And everything I said to him, he was confirming. And all of a sudden we get near his house, because my plan was to pull over, and there's a big wide area there, and just witness to him. But he gets a phone call from his dad. And his dad said, where are you at? We got a house full of people and you need to be here. And then now all of a sudden everything changes as far as pressure goes. And the last thing I would want to do is rush somebody through that I don't want Christless grace because I did a bad job of witnessing. So I said, hey, I'm going to come get you tomorrow. We're going to finish this. Well, tomorrow, my brother-in-law happened, and I was called to go out of town because he didn't have long to live. And I called Pastor Terry. And you remember what I told you about him? What would I tell you? He's right. He's low-hanging fruit. And it wasn't no time. Yeah, he got saved. And that was a team of 3 people working on that young man. But it was sincere. That's a ripe opportunity, okay? But you can also preach Christ always if you want to. There's a way to do that. And for those of us who, just to be frank, aren't comfortable always preaching Christ, some of you guys are. I admire that. I'm not that way. I'm not going to pretend like I am. But there is a way that we can preach Christ always. There is a way we can always preach Christ by simply doing this. There's a saying that says, preach Christ always. And when necessary, use words. Now that's how you preach Christ always. They will look at you and your life and your profession and your testimony. And whether they ever say a word to you about Christ or salvation, they're watching. And what they're watching is this the real deal or not? And you know what? You may be the real deal, but you may not show it in your testimony. That's not going to change your eternity, but it might change his eternity. And that's a responsibility you have on you that I believe we will answer for someday. That's part of that judgment. So if we preach Christ always, and when necessary we use words, that's our way of preaching Christ always. I tell you what happens. When you do that, there'll be a time where they're going to make it easy on you. They really see the real thing because they've seen so much of the fake thing in their lives that they really don't want no part of it. And the greatest thing in the world is when they say to you, I want what you have. I want what you have. When they do that, that makes the fruit ripe and they're ready. Now, I'm not saying that all the other methods, absolutely, street preaching, going door to door, knocking on doors and random just encounters, people at the restaurant, tracks, all those things are effective. All those things are good. But what I'm talking about right here is a little more personal, a little more involved, and a little more of actual discipleship as Christ modeled and Paul modeled in their converts. You know, sometimes it's a process that takes a long time until the event of salvation happens instantaneously, okay? And everybody in this room has people they've been witnessing to for years, and it's not happened. Well, what do? We keep doing what we do. We keep doing what we do. Adrian Rogers said the greatest argument for Christianity is also the greatest argument against Christianity. It's the life of a Christian. Isn't that sad? Seriously, that's amazing. Be a Paul. Paul looked for every opportunity he could to segue the gospel into the everyday grind of life. I mean, he's making tents and he's witnessing the people making tents with him. He's in Corinth and he's looking at Athens and he's seeing things that he's thinking to himself, how can I take this and make it relevant to what I want to say to these guys? That's what we're supposed to be like, looking for those opportunities. Look at 1 Corinthians 15:34. Look at 1 Corinthians 15:34. Corinthians 15:34 says, Paul speaking, awake to righteousness. Well, if he's telling us to wake to righteousness, that means we're asleep in unrighteousness. Okay? So he's telling us, awake to righteousness. And then he reiterates that by saying, and sin not. Don't be a disgrace to grace. Don't be a disgrace to grace. Being a disgrace to grace simply means that whatever you do in the way of destroying your testimony or hurting your testimony, you're going to cover it by saying, God will forgive me. Okay. And Romans 6:1 will specifically tell you that that's not how it's supposed to work. Okay. Don't be a disgrace to grace. Now, he says, awake to righteousness and sin not. And here's where really rubber hits the road. It says, for some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. Wow. Think about that. Think about everybody, guys, that we encounter. Think about those right moments that we know the Holy Spirit is speaking to us, to speak to them, and we don't do it. I don't. I've done it many times. And I've driven away or I've walked away, and I think to myself, I know I should have witnessed to that person. And there's some reason I didn't do it. I know what the reason is. Satan wasn't sitting on my shoulders poking me and saying, don't do it, Gary, don't do it. That's a fairy tale. You know, Satan is not omniscient. He's not omnipotent. He can't be everywhere at all times. That's a misnomer. The devil made me do it. No, the devil has set up a world system so that he don't have to do that. We are so in tune to the culture of the world that we start worrying about what the world thinks instead of what God thinks. And in those situations right there, it's not Satan talking me out of witnessing to so-and-so. It's Gary talking me out of witnessing to so-and-so. because of my mindset and the culture that we live in. You know, I don't want to offend him. That's not the truth. It's pride. It's pride. We just don't do it. For some have not knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame. That's an accountability issue. And that accountability issue is what Christ was talking about in Hebrews. He says, all creatures, everything, naked and open to the eyes of him with whom we have to do. As Dilbert's mentioned a couple of times, I've written a book. And the name of the book is Lessons from a Layman. And what the book is about is just the fact that, like many people in here, I was never formally educated as far as theology goes or any of those things. And when I wrote that, I was able to say, I'm not a pastor, I'm not a song leader, I'm not any of those things. I'm just a Christian and I'm a layman. And here's how I see things from a layman's perspective. And that book is getting ready to be printed, and one of these days I'm gonna have it out there for sale. All the proceeds of that book will go to the jail ministry, every penny of it. Even what I have in it, I don't care. I'm not worried about it. But that's what my goal is, and hopefully God will honor and bless that, and it'll raise some money for the jail ministry. But one of the poems in that book that I wrote is a poem called Christless Graves, of all things. It says this. It says, all alone in fields of stone, the sundry markers speak. One by one, when life is done, with the occupants they seek. Did they embrace the gift of grace from Jesus Christ that saves? Or are those tombs just empty rooms that ensconce the Christless graves? One must say it's only clay that rests beside that stone, with body dead and spirit fled to realms that are unknown. The epitaphs are autographs that never will reveal if lives we live and regard we give to Christ was truly real. One by one, we'll face the sun, and judgment will incur. Then we'll be known as his own, or if we never were. For when we die, those stones might lie about our endless fate. But God will tell if it's heaven or hell that will be our final state. Guys, it's a huge responsibility we have. And it doesn't have to be something that we lose sleep over. It would be nice if it was just so natural to us that we look for opportunities when they present themselves. I'm not even talking about getting out there and presenting them for you. That's great. A lot of you guys are at that point in your lives. A lot of us aren't. But if we just get into a situation where that opportunity presents itself, we have the boldness and the courage to speak up for Christ, and it especially helps if we have the lifestyle to go behind it that backs it, then we'll be doing what our job is, what we're supposed to do. Thank you. I think I got done too early.
I got a poem and a short devotion with it. I'll send you both. I'll send it today. I'll send it today.